formal, but it's actually intended to be a little bit more concrete than the other parallel series of lectures. So before we actually start talking about some of these techniques, and we really won't get to our first set till tomorrow, we have to lay the groundwork. But before we even lay the groundwork, I want to talk a little bit about the motivation and the background and the context, and maybe talk about some things that you probably won't have seen in other courses, although I'll query you as I go on. So the idea is that we want to, well, we have developed some tools for computing amplitudes in the standard model. And the primary focus is going to be on QCD, the SU3 of the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, because that's the most significant, as I'll try to convince you in this introduction, and also because it's where the computations are the hardest, and so there's the greatest need for new ideas and new techniques. Of course, we need to look a little bit at the context and how we understand collider physics from a theoretical point of view. Again, material that may be familiar to some of you, but probably not to everyone. And then we'll say a few words about kind of the goals of theoretical computations in recent years and upcoming years in preparation for the next run, well, the already ongoing or starting next run of the LHC. So we have now, with what's now almost old news, the discovery of the Higgs. It's really looking more and more standard model-like as time goes on and more data is collected. And of course, every discovery opens new doors and it raises new questions. And so in the case of the Higgs, we'd like to know how much like the standard model is it? How close or how far are any indications of physics beyond the standard model in the Higgs sector? And of course, to do that, we're going to have to be able to compare our standard model expectations, in particular, there are very large QCD corrections, to what the experiments actually see. The other is, of course, an ongoing quest that has been pursued maybe to the disappointment of some experimenters, certainly to the disappointment of those people in the theory community who have been very fervent proponents of low-energy supersymmetry. The question, is there anything else hiding in that LHC data? And again, we have to understand the backgrounds. We have to understand the known physics to see if there are any discrepancies and see if there really is something hiding. So if we look at an event, and this is actually taken from quite a while ago, coming out of ATLAS, then kind of the standard picture. This is what the event would look like if you were staring down the beam pipe. Well, actually, your head would get blown off if you were staring down the beam pipe. So this is what a computer reconstruction of it is. We have the tracking, electromagnetic calorimetry, hadronic calorimetry. And you can see there's large numbers of tracks, a lot of activity in both the calorimetry, not too much activity in this particular event in the muon chambers. And we can take this is sort of the beam's eye view, we can slice that cylinder, which is wrapping, first of all, essentially project everything onto some standard surface and then unwrap it. So then we would have the azimuthal angle running this way, and then we'd have along the beam pipe, we'd have an axis running this way, expressed in rapidity units, so differences are going to be boost invariant, which is the natural thing to do. And the vertical scale here is the energy in towers or energy in tracks. And this is kind of a sideways view. Again, you can see that these events are very, very dense. And as the luminosity grows, not only will we have essentially one proton-proton collision, but we'll have many of them, so then we'll have even denser events, and then there's more backgrounds due to what's called pileup that needs to be disentangled. So we have lots of particles in a typical event, and they're mostly hadrons. And what you noticed, we'll come back to that picture in a second, is that they're actually not spread uniformly. They're really collimated into streams. And these streams are called jets of hadrons. So heuristically, the way that, in fact, older experiments at the Tevatron thought about these things is that you have some circle in that azimuthal-angle rapidity plane, and you're trying to collect the energy in that circle, and you have different circles spread out, and each one is kind of a jet. So intuitively, you want to think about there's some a cone, and if you're tracing back to the event, and there's some amount of energy that's gathered within it, and that kind of represents a jet. Now, the modern point of view is that actually you have to define a jet by an algorithm. And there have been a variety of algorithms over time. It was kind of a slow process understanding what algorithms actually made sense from a theorist's point of view. There's basically one algorithm that has kind of won out really over all the others because it has nice properties from a theorist's point of view. And on the other hand, it actually produces things that are pretty close to these nice circular jets that the experimenters like. And this algorithm is a sequential clustering algorithm. Sequential clustering algorithms had their start in electron-positron collisions. And the idea was to design an algorithm that respects the emission structure of QCD. So we have everything projected onto this surface, which we've unwrapped, the cylinder, which we've unwrapped. And now we want to define a distance measure inside the cylinder, which is called delta R. How many people have heard of delta R before? Good. So this is review. So there's, of course, a difference in the azimuthal angle. You might think maybe one should use cosine or something like that, but if these jets are supposed to be small, it shouldn't, or sine, it shouldn't really matter that much. And again, there's a difference in rapidity. It's a little bit too quick there. The rapidity is not actually vanishing in spite of the bug in the PowerPoint. And we then want to go around and we have the energy or the transverse momentum, so that's the momentum projected onto a plane that's transverse to the beam axis. Again, that's a boost invariant object. Doesn't really matter whether the overall collision, the short distance collision, was moving somewhere longitudinally or not. And we're going to look at all pairs of particles, all pairs of towers, all pairs of sequentially recombined things. And we're going to take this quantity, we're going to measure delta R divided by some parameter R0. We're going to take the minimum of this transverse energy to some power. And then there's another invariant that we're also going to look at, which is just the transverse energy to that power. And the idea is that we pick the smallest of all these quantities. And if it's a pair of them, then we simply recombine. We add the two particles together, we add their four momenta together. And then that combined object, we now have a transverse momentum again, and it's ready for the next phase of the algorithm. If it happens to be just a lone DI, something just the transverse momentum itself, we set it aside as a protojet. And we keep on doing this until we can't do this anymore. So eventually we reach a point where there's no more combinations to be made, no more protojets to be set aside. And now we look at our list of protojets, and those protojets that pass some minimum PT, that is, they have the KT satisfies some minimum value, those are the ones that we actually declare jets. So depending on the values of R0 and PT, we will get more or fewer jets in an event. So a jet is unlike, to some extent, let's say a muon. a jet is not an intrinsically defined object. It's something that depends on your parameters, and that's due to the infrared structure of the theory. In fact, it's not so unfamiliar because there's something analogous to that in QED, which is something that you may have even learned in your field theory courses. And if I'm so inspired, and if there's time towards the end of the week, we'll come back to talk a little bit more about infrared issues. So it turns out that the historical and kind of the natural choice of P would have actually been P equals 1, or maybe P equals 0. P equals minus 1 is extraordinarily counterintuitive unless you have a very deep understanding of the radiation structure. But that is, in fact, the one that gives these jets that the experimenters like, and that's the standard choice in both ATLAS and CMS, and I would expect, really, in most future experiments, unless there's some refinement of this that comes about. So again, if we go back and look at our event, then you can see that depending on where I set this minimum PT, I said this was an 8-jet event, but that's just with the standard ATLAS descriptions. If I made this R0 radius larger, then, for example, I might end up actually merging these two together. If I made the jet PT cut higher, I might end up discarding this jet and that jet. So the number of jets in an event and where they are depends on these parameters. And these parameters are really there to separate the hard physics from the soft physics, things that you can't really control in perturbation theory. So the other thing that's worth remembering about jets, and this is actually, again, quite an old plot, in this case from CMS. I try to be even-handed with the two LHC experiments, lest there be anyone who will go back and report to his supervisor that I only showed plots from the other collaboration, and then I will get an angry phone call in the middle of the night. Anyway, so if you look at these distributions, then you can see that there certainly, even then, there were events with 7, 8, 9 jets, and by now we have, 20 times more data, so we're going to certainly even start to be able to do distributions with 10 jets. So we have to have a theoretical picture of events that really have a very large number of jets. And in fact, if you think about some of the beyond the standard model searches, again, they involve decay chains that tend to produce large numbers of jets. So that's something we need to be able to calculate. So to quote a great American philosopher, in theory and practice are the same, but in practice, they're different. And they're different because QCD is very hard. So jets ultimately are a reflection of the structure, the physics of QCD, and full QCD is extremely complicated. We have already a very rich and complicated structure at very short distance in perturbation theory. And then there's a very poorly understood transition to the non-perturbative domain, and even the things that we can calculate, and the lattice people can by now calculate a very impressive list of things in the non-perturbative domain, even that is very hard. And you have to start to measure the calculations in the amount of energy that the computers are going to consume in doing that. And certainly for these kinds of events, it's really only the perturbative part of QCD, the part where the coupling is small, the part that corresponds to very short distance, high momentum transfer, that's really tractable. And so the way we're going to do these calculations is in the so-called QCD-improved parton model. And we're going to do them for quantities that are suitably average so as to be what's called infrared and collinear safe, which means that they're not sensitive to the long-distance physics from a perturbative design. They really only care about the short-distance interactions. And if you study those kinds of quantities, you discover that the non-perturbative corrections are power-like, and they're at least parametrically smaller than the higher-order perturbative corrections. So to give you a picture, then if we look at the LHC, we have two protons colliding. Well, ideally, we would have in any given time slice exactly one interaction between two protons. That's not real life. In real life, as I mentioned earlier, there can be multiple collisions, and that adds additional complications for the experimenters. But again, theorists, we're just going to ignore that. Out of each of the protons, we're going to pull a parton, and it's those partons that are going to have this very high transverse momentum, short distance interaction. There's going to be a scattering. And of course, just as in the scattering of charged particles in electrodynamics, if you scatter charged particles, here they're charged under SU3, then there's going to be radiation that's emitted in the course of that scattering. And it's that radiation that we're going to try and compute order by order in perturbation theory. It comes really in two kinds. There's the real radiation, where you actually have additional gluons that are emitted. And there's also the virtual gluons that tie some of these legs together. And again, those are things that we're going to compute in perturbation theory. So in a sense, really, the right way from a theorist point of view is to think about the LHC not as a proton-proton collider, but as a parton-parton collider. For certain things, it might even be just gluon-gluon. For other things, gluon-quark. And then the kind of formula you get for your cross-section or differential cross-section, imagine that we're looking at some distribution, we're going to have the short-distance matrix element. And that's, in fact, the rest of this course. We'll be focusing on techniques for computing this at different orders in perturbation theory. There's a probability of pulling out that parton out of proton A or proton B. We have to integrate over all the momentum fractions. What fraction of the momentum of the proton can each of the incoming partons A and B carry? And it's, of course, because XA is not equal in general to XB that the event, the short distance scattering, in general has some longitudinal boost. And that's why even if the two protons had identical energies, and they're pretty close, but not maybe completely identical, then we would still have to worry about that because the partons have radically different energies. There's an integral over the phase space of the outgoing partons, and finally there'll be some delta function, which in a computer code you would implement by binning. People have seen this in their courses before? Let's have a show of hands. Who has? Okay. I won't make the other people raise their hands.
What is actually V? V is not something that I...
V is just some observable that's computed from the momenta in the process. I mean, this is supposed to be a schematic kind of formula. So the challenge is that everything really in a hadron collider, and I'm focusing more on the idea of backgrounds for the most part, but the signals also, and certainly even things like the luminosity measurement, involves QCD in some fashion or another. And the strong coupling is not small. So if we look at the strong coupling evaluated at a momentum scale of the Z mass, it's about 0.12, teeny bit less. And running is also important. So as we vary the momentum scale which we're probing a given process, that coupling will change. So that means that compared to maybe our intuitions from QED, that first of all, there are going to be a large multiplicity of these clusters. We have events with lots of jets. We've already seen a distribution of that. Each jet is going to have ultimately a lot of associated radiation that's coming along with it, and that's going to turn into a large number of hadrons. And it also means that the quantum corrections, the radiative corrections, are going to be important. Now, there's another aspect, which is that we can also have many disparate scales that arise in a problem. And a classic example of that is for example, if we're looking at production of a W boson, it can be produced at very low transverse momentum, but the mass of it is, well, by LHC standards, not so high, but it's still over nearly a couple orders of magnitude away from a typical, typical cutoff for a transverse energy. So there can be logarithms of these ratios of scales that arise. And in fact, there are double logarithms that arise when one starts to look at large PTs, because there again, one has the issue of Sudikoff logarithms that again arise from this ratio scale. In general, you need to resum those logarithms. That's something which I'm not going to talk about anymore. So you can see again, if you look, and this is a compilation of lattice and data taken at various energies, in which there are also some collider contributions. And it's something that you can really see experimentally, the running of alpha s. And that's, I think, really a wonderful confirmation to look at. So if one looks at the kind of tools or the approaches that theorists make in order to understand, in order to make predictions about QCD-related backgrounds, then one can imagine doing this at fixed order in perturbation theory. And most of what I'm going to be talking about is kind of geared to fit into that program. It's something which you can systematically go to higher order or higher multiplicity. It has the defect from an experimenter's point of view of being a parton level approach. So we cannot compare event by event, an event that comes out of this kind of theory calculation, a theory Monte Carlo, as they're sometimes called because of the integration algorithms, but a theoretical event cannot be compared with a detector event. You can only do this at the level of distributions. You can only do it statistically. The approach that the experimenters like is something called parton showers, because here you can actually look event by event. You're really trying to simulate the radiation that comes along with this hard scattering, and ultimately even add on a model for the conversion of partons to hadrons, so that in the detector you can really look at hadrons. The problem is that here you only know how to do this at kind of leading log, or maybe next to leading log order, and so that means that if you're going to higher multiplicity or to higher accuracy, at least the basic approach is only approximate. It's not something that's systematic. One thing that really is now fairly well understood is how to combine these two approaches at leading order in perturbation theory. And there's a lot of understanding of how to do it at even at next to leading order. It's not by any means a closed subject, however. So one of the drivers for doing higher order calculations has to do with trying to understand things quantitatively. And one of the places that we have to come back to is the question of a renormalization scale and the dependence of predictions on the renormalization scale. So in QCD, as in other quantum field theories, we have to define the coupling. We have to define the coupling by relating some parameter in our theory to an experimental measurement. And of course, the way we define it, it shouldn't change the way we make predictions about experiments. The physical quantities should be independent of this renormalization scale. The problem is that when we truncate the perturbation theory, leaving aside the fact that the perturbation theory is asymptotic and certainly in a theory like QCD, it doesn't really make sense to resum it. Even if we could resum it, then we might not have to worry about it. But in fact, for most quantities, we can do 1, 2, 3, maybe for some exceptional things, 4 orders. And so there's some residual dependence, and that's characteristically the first missing order, the first order that we have in computed time, some logarithms. And then there's a similar situation for the factorization scale. Again, the probabilities of finding partons inside the proton, again, that's ultimately given by some operator, and we have to define it at some given scale. And that scale, which in some sense is separating the long-distance physics that we have to take from experiments from the short-distance physics that we hope to compute, is called the factorization scale. And again, exactly how we do that separation, it shouldn't matter. But in practice, because we're doing truncated perturbation theory, there is a dependence. So imagine that we have some observable that's sensible in perturbation theory, and that is going to mean here that it's infrared and collinear safe. If you imagine taking a gluon and you split it into two collinear gluons, there's a singularity associated with that, but the observable should be insensitive to that. So for example, trying to count the number of partons is a very infrared unsafe kind of thing to do. If you're trying to measure the energy inside a jet, that's characteristically, if the jet algorithm is an appropriate one, that's characteristically an infrared safe thing to do. So every observable has an expansion in alpha s, and the leading order in that expansion depends on the particular observable. And you can imagine going to higher orders in the perturbative expansion each time you go to, so the leading order is the lowest order at which you have a contribution, and then there's the next order called next to leading order, next to next to leading order, and for some quantities, people have even gone to next to next to next to leading order, although by the time you get beyond NNLO, you usually abbreviate it to N cubed LO as opposed to tying your tongue in knots, saying lots of nexts in a row. So imagine that we're looking at production of W in association with one jet. We can look at the spectrum of those jets, the differential of this distribution with respect to the transverse energy of the jet that you've identified. And there's going to be a leading order term, which is formally of order alpha s. There's going to be a next leading order term, which is formally of order alpha s squared, and so on and so forth. We could also imagine looking not at production of W plus one jet, but W plus two jets, and looking at the distribution of the second jet, for example. Then the leading order term is going to be of order alpha s squared, because there's two jets. Each jet, production of each jet is going to cost you an alpha s. The next to leading order term is going to be of order alpha s cubed, and so on and so forth. You have to look at the observable to determine what's the leading order. You can't just say, oh, it's alpha s cubed, therefore it must be next to leading order. It's not the way the organization works. Yes?
Do you mean by sensible that we can get a theory prediction for a measurement, or what do you mean?
Well, strictly speaking, when I say sensible, I mean precisely infrared and collinear safe. There's a slightly larger class of observables for which you can, for example, make some kind of prediction. But generally speaking, something that you can reliably compute in perturbation theory is something that's infrared and collinear safe. There can be aspects of infrared and collinear safe observables that still have quirks to them. So there may, in some circumstances, be stronger constraints that are required. So one thing I want you to keep in mind is that you'll notice that I've put in here kind of a mu. That's the renormalization scale or inside the cross-section, the factorization scale as well. And I've tried to indicate something here by the lack of dependence in the leading order cross-section. So the dependence here is coming through the strong coupling alone, whereas there's also in the next to leading order contributions, there's an additional dependence on mu. And that's actually significant, because that's how you get a significant improvement when you're going from leading order to next to leading order. And the basic problem, if you're thinking about something like QED or phi cubed or the nonlinear sigma model, you think, well, I have a quantitative prediction at leading order, and I can refine it if the corrections are large when I go to higher orders. And the problem is QCD is not quite like that at the colliders. And we'll see that an example of that in a second. You have a very large dependence on these unphysical parameters, on the renormalization scale in particular. And that means that really the first order which you get a quantitative prediction is, in fact, the so-called next leading order. It's really kind of like the first quantitative order. And as it turns out, experience shows that with some explanation, you can expect it to be reliable to about 10 to 15%. And it's precisely the loop corrections, the virtual corrections, that introduce a compensating dependence on the scale mu and allow the sensitivity to be more modest. The other thing is that it's also at this order that you get the first approximation to jet substructure. So if you think about it, leading order, you're modeling every jet by a single parton that's flying out from the short distance scattering. And that's a very crude picture because jets are fat. They have some substructure. And you get the first approximation to that at next to leading order. And I mean, this is something where there's been a huge amount of progress and development in the last decade or so, thanks in part to some of the techniques that we'll be seeing during this week. And a lot of the focus is now, it's not a closed subject, but a lot of the focus is now shifting to really being able to do precision predictions. We're hoping that the experimenter's error budget shrinks because their measurements get much more accurate, so that they're not willing to tolerate 10 to 15% theoretical uncertainties, and they're going to ask for 5%. You need to go to one order beyond that. It means instead of doing the one loop calculations that require that are needed for the virtual corrections here, you're going to be doing two-loop corrections, and there's also a lot of assembly, which is more complicated in this case. And here, of course, you're going to now get a better approximation to the jet substructure as well. So let's just take a quick look at some real-world examples. So this is from a series of calculations of production of a W minus in association with some number of jets, two jets, three jets, four jets, and five jets. And this shows the cross-section on the vertical axis in each of these different slices with some standard cuts for the LHC. There's restrictions on the jet PT, for example. There's also restrictions on the reconstruction of the W. I won't go through this in detail. And the horizontal axis, there's some standard renormalization scale that's picked it, and then I've picked a variation around it. So again, this is a variation of an unphysical parameter, so the physical predictions here should be just flat horizontal lines. And I think we can all agree that none of these lines resemble a flat horizontal line. Some of them are better than others, though. If we look at the dashed blue lines, those are the leading order predictions. And on general grounds from field theory, you can certainly argue that I shouldn't take mu r to be way out there at a factor of 100 or 1,000 or something like that. But it's not clear that that this ratio should be order 1 or a half or 2. And kind of these uncertainty estimates are usually made completely by convention by varying up and down by a factor of 2 or so. And you can see that there's a significant variation in the predicted cross-sections for these different quantities. And that prediction gets substantially worse. So you might be off by a factor of several by the time you're out to W plus 5 jets. It gets significantly worse as the number of jets increases. Now, if you go to the next to leading order curves, which are shown in black, then you can see that they're not perfect yet. They're certainly not flat lines yet. But you can see that the variation is much more modest. And in fact, it turns out to be in this characteristic 10 to 15% over the range mu r's a half to a factor of 2. Yes?
If you apply jet matching and put on k factors to rescale your distributions, do you have a feeling for how close would you be to the NLO line, let's say?
Well, I mean, the first of all, that's actually an interesting point I'll come back to in the next transparency. So there's more to the game than just some overall rescaling. And the other thing is that you can see that it's not really clear how you should go about choosing that k factor without having done the next to leading order calculation. But if you've done the calculation, you should use it. So, I also couldn't resist the urge to show a slightly more detailed version. This is in W plus 4 jets, again, not just looking at the total cross-section, but looking at a bunch of distributions. In fact, the spectra of the hardest jet, the next to hardest jet, the next to next to hardest jet, and finally the fourth jet. And again, it's kind of hard to see exactly what's going on these scales where we're actually looking at the differential cross-section with respect to PT, because there's a huge number of decades that we're trying to look at. So it's actually easier to look at the ratio to the best available calculation. Some people might argue one should really be putting data there, but at least when this was generated, there was no data yet, or at least not good enough to be putting on the plot. So we take the ratio to NLO, and now we can see things a lot more clearly. So first of all, there's the scale dependence band at leading order is shown by this hatched brown area, and at next to leading order by the gray band. There are some spikes here, but they correspond to the region where there's actually a kinematic cutoff, and the cross-section itself is also very small. So again, we see this tremendous shrinking of the uncertainty due to scale variation. In other words, we're really getting a quantitative prediction. The other thing that's worth noting is that the ratio of leading order to next to leading order here is not flat. So there's not just a single k factor that characterizes the calculation. You really have to look distribution by distribution. This distribution, it is flat. This distribution, it isn't flat.
But if you apply like jet matching, then in principle, you are including some distribution effects. So it's not clear to me, based on this, that you're not going to be reduced by distribution.
Well, if all you're doing, let's say, in a parton shower, I mean, I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to in terms of jet matching. You're not solving the issue of the scale variation. In fact, you never really see the scale variation uncertainty shown on parton shower plots because it's actually very hard to estimate. But people are essentially fixing mu in a parton shower calculation in some particular way, but that doesn't mean that the uncertainty is not there. It's just they're not showing it to you. So if you're doing ultimately a leading log plus leading order calculation, you're not getting rid of this problem. So they may not be telling you. I mean, I could have done the leading order calculation, not done the scale variation, and said, hey, you know, that's the line I'm getting. So really to understand what's going on, you have to do the NLO calculation. Now, you could say in the fullness of time, ultimately we'll also do NNLO calculations that we'll have some idea of how to go back to a leading order calculation and choose a scale appropriately, but it's we're very far from that.
My naive intuition for this is that the soft jets be more sensitive to the high order correction, so why is the fourth jet seems to agree with this?
Well, that's a kind of dependent on the cuts and the way you choose the scale and things like that. I wouldn't read anything too much into it. Certainly the fact that it happens to come, the fact that it's flat does seem to be a characteristic of the last jet. The fact that it's around one here, I wouldn't read very much into that. That's I could change that by changing the way I chose the scale and probably also the way I chose the cuts and things of that sort. So that's the kind of background that I wanted to give in the context and sort of give you an idea of the goals, the physical objects which we're going to plug it into. And now we'll actually start to look at some of the techniques that have been used. Does someone know how to raise the, good. Good. Ah, yeah, so it's the man behind the curtain, obviously the most important person here. And if we could also have the lights there. Thank you. So I'm not going to entertain you with any discussion of why Feynman diagrams get to be very difficult. Sung-hae mentioned that a little bit in the morning lecture. I'm hoping you're just willing to take it, maybe not on faith, but on the weight of lots of experience. And so what we're going to look for or have developed are so-called on-shell methods to make all these calculations either more efficient or in some ways more tractable analytically. So the idea behind on-shell methods is that we want to use information only from physical on-shell states. That doesn't mean that inside the trees, inside the loops, we don't have virtual particles circulating. It just means we're not going to use that information directly to compute amplitudes. We're going to deduce that information indirectly. And that indirect deduction is going to come by using only on-shell objects. If that sounds mysterious, then by the end of the week, you will be able to go and explain it to your fellow graduate students or postdocs at your home institutions. The other idea, the other key idea here, is to use general properties of amplitudes and turn them into tools for calculating. So what do we know about amplitudes in quantum field theory? Well, they satisfy certain factorization properties. We'll see more of that tomorrow and Wednesday. And that we can use to derive the on-shell or BCFW. These are two names, not two different recursions, but two different names for the same set of recursion relations. And we'll see how that works in some detail. A sensible theory has a unitary S matrix, and that allows us to, first of all, write down a so-called unitarity method, and then later to generalize it, and what might be called the analyticity method, or is called generalized unitarity. And throughout all of this, we're going to keep track of the fact that we have an underlying field theory. And that tells us a lot about properties of the structure of amplitudes, and in particular, at loop level, it tells us all about the integrals that are present. So we're not going to be doing any Feynman diagrams. Well, I may ask you as an exercise to do one or two. But we certainly are going to need Feynman integrals, and they continue to play a key a role in any object that we calculate. You can also still use the, even though we don't want to calculate with them, we can certainly use Feynman diagrams for Gedanken arguments. So along the lines of, imagine that you were to do a calculation, here are the general properties of that calculation, and here are the kinds of things that that come out. And these things are useful. So I think one of the interesting lessons of the whole development of the amplitudes subfield in recent years is sometimes the emerging idea that there can be many different representations of a field, quantum field theory, and there can be many different representations of amplitudes, and different representations are useful for different purposes, calculating things, understanding properties of them, understanding symmetries. So there was a long period of time when basically a field theory meant a path integral and nothing else was really to be admitted as a way of thinking about field theory. And I think we're evolving away from that. And there's exactly what the rich final picture will be is still going to take years or decades to work out. But I think that's part of the idea here, is that you should be willing to look at field theories and willing to look at amplitudes from many different directions. And there can be many different tools, many different approaches that are useful. So before we can actually start to look at these properties and apply them to calculations, we have to talk a little bit about kinematics. And we're going to start by focusing on massless states, massless particles. So we need to think about four momenta that are on shell, that are massless and on shell. And the techniques that I'm talking about can be applied, of course, beyond that, but they're the most natural, and it's easiest to see their full development in this setting. And as it so happens, it's also a very natural setting for doing collider physics, because at let's say, at a momentum transfer of 500 GeV, even the B quark, which is pretty heavy if you're thinking about it compared to the pion, is essentially massless. The corrections are, for the most part, small. And our first task is to learn how to take a square root of this vector. So those of you who have seen lectures on this before then know how this story goes on. But the rest of you will just have to hold on. So let's introduce the four vector of Pauli matrices. Just the usual set that you learned in undergraduate quantum mechanics, supplemented by a sigma zero, which is just the identity matrix. So this is a 2x2 matrix. And I'm writing it with a lower index, and that's why there's this maybe somewhat odd-looking minus sign. Minus here. So this thing actually can be thought of as having two indices, one running up and down and the other running this way. And it'll be natural. I want you to start thinking about these indices not as rows 1 and 2, but as rows 0 and 1, and not as columns 1 and 2, but as columns 0 and 1. So the first thing we can do with this four vector is we can rewrite our momentum and turn it into a matrix. And we do that by defining, again, an object with two indices. One undotted and one dotted is kind of the convention inherited from supersymmetry, but I think maybe from earlier in the math literature. We're going to define that as the dot product of K and sigma. And we can write it as follows. So one thing that we can notice is that, we can just play around with this matrix, and we can notice that we can take its determinant. Well, we're going to get k naught squared minus k3 squared, and then this thing is going to be, again, it's going to be, this product is going to be k1 squared plus k2 squared, but there's a minus sign from taking the determinant. So this determinant is exactly k squared. It's the four vector, the Lorentz product of the four vector with itself. I won't say much more, but if you have, let me actually not hide this from you. There. In this language, then if a Lorentz transformation on the 4 vector has the form of some 4 by 4 matrix, in this language, in terms of the matrices, then it's a kind of conjugation operation where this matrix is an element of SL2C. That is to say, the 2 by 2 complex matrices with determinant 1. That requirement on the determinant being what's needed to preserve this relationship. So, if we're thinking about massless particles, then our determinant vanishes. The determinant could vanish in a trivial way if k were actually zero, but that's really not very interesting, or if k is non-zero. If k is non-zero, it's a 2 by 2 matrix and it has one zero eigenvalue in order to make the determinant zero. That means that it has rank 1. And that in turn means that we can actually write it as an outer product of two vectors. Let me write it in this form. Now, K itself is complex, so these vectors are going to have to be complex. And so each of these is a complex 2-vector. And each one has a separate SL2C index. And these indices, by convention, are going to run over the values 0 and 1. So that's why I want you to think of these rows and columns as not labeled 1 and 2, but labeled 0 and 1. So if we think of an amplitude as being a function of some variables that are characterizing the external particles, there might be spins or other things, but one thing that they're definitely going to be dependent on are the momenta. So if we think of the amplitudes as functions of some variables, which are the momenta, then this is telling us we can also think of them as functions, should be a tilde here, excuse me, as functions of these variables, the lambdas and the lambda tildes, and these are called spinner variables. Now, I want to emphasize that these are bosonic objects. There's no Grassmanns here. I haven't introduced any Grassmann variables here. These things are not fermionic. They're perfectly bosonic objects. And you should get, if you're going to work in this subject, you should get used to working with them because they are your friends. So the natural invariant tensor for SL2C is in fact a two-dimensional epsilon symbol. And we have one each for each of the two indices. So we have epsilon alpha beta and epsilon alpha dot beta dot. So if we have something that transforms under a group and we have an invariant tensor, then the natural thing to do, think about the Lorentz symmetry. We have something that has a Lorentz index. We have an invariant tensor, which is g mu nu or a w nu, depending on what you want to call it. It's natural to form bilinears out of these things, and that's an invariant. So the natural thing for us to do here is to form these bilinears. So for example, epsilon alpha beta, lambda alpha, lambda prime beta. And these objects with the great imagination are called spinner products. Now, if you're a disciple of Steven Weinberg, then you adore carrying lots of indices around and writing all indices out explicitly. I'm a great admirer of the man, one of the great physicists of the past century, but I'm not such a great fan of carrying all the indices around, and a lot of other people aren't either. So it's convenient to introduce some notation, more compact notation. In general, we're going to have some number of external momenta. So let's imagine we have some endpoint amplitude. We're going to have kn. These are all four vectors, but we're actually just going to label them by 1 through n. In fact, you already saw this in the first lecture this morning. And so the J now denotes one of those indices. And we're going to define a ket notation for these spinners. And actually, we're even too lazy to keep writing out the pluses and the minuses, so let's just drop the plus and write it this way. And so the index is implicit and so on and so forth. And the fact that it's a lambda is encoded in the notation. And we also have spinners of the other flavor, the lambda tilde flavor. So that's going to be J with an alpha dot. And again, we're kind of lazy to be writing the pluses and the minuses all the time, but these are two different objects, so we need a different notation. I guess in some alphabet, what follows an angle bracket is an ordinary bracket, so there we are. And we can raise indices, of course, with an epsilon tensor, so that's going to correspond to epsilon, lambda j, lambda beta, and this thing is just going to be called j, and then finally the remaining spinner is just gotten from raising the index on a dotted guy, and he's going to be, again, labeled with a bracket. So remember that we don't have any invariant tensors that carry, that mix the left and the right indices, so we can tie lambdas together, we can tie lambda tildes together. In other words, you can put angle brackets together with angle brackets and ordinary brackets together with ordinary brackets. And that is, in fact, what we want to do. So we have, for example, ij is equal to just the inner product of I plus angle I plus, minus plus. And that thing is going to be epsilon alpha beta times lambda I alpha lambda j beta. So it's still the same object. I'm just cleaning up the notation a little bit. And there's, of course, also the bracket product, which here is the plus minus combination. And here is alpha dot beta dot. And so here we come to the first warning about the literature, that there are actually two conventions as to whether this should be J and I or I and J. So I think everyone basically agrees on the sign of angle IJ. And there are two different conventions depending on whether it's more QCD oriented or whether it's more N equals 4 oriented, two different conventions on what the sign of the bracket product is. So when you're, if you're ever confused, just if you're ever, you know, trying to reproduce a paper and you're finding some discrepancy, then make sure you have the right sign convention. So we can actually give, and at the moment, these are all formal objects. You think, you know, well, we can play with them and shuffle indices around and have all this notation, but can we actually compute something with them? And the answer is yes, we can give an explicit representation of these two-dimensional spinners. So the first thing we want to do is define the light cone momenta. So this is just k naught plus or minus k3. Of course, the choice of the z axis is arbitrary but conventional. And it's also convenient to define a phase. And by looking at the transverse components, by the way, it should be I'm not even sure it's 5 minutes, but here's an exercise. Show that phi k is real. In other words, that this thing really is a phase. And then we can write explicit forms of for the lambda spinner. And for the lambda tilde spinner, of course, now once you have this explicit form, then it's a straightforward exercise to write out what the spinner products are. And we have, for example, a formula for ij, which we can write in terms of, let's say, hope the subscripts are still legible here. So and we have a similar formula for the bracket product, but as you might guess from the representation here, I hope this is clear, this is a minus and not just a slip of the chalk. And again, the sign convention is different. So if the energies are positive, then we actually find that this product, the two products are related, at least for everything that we've considered thus far, for external momentum and physical process, by a complex conjugation, or more generally, that they're related by phase, which is determined by the signs of the energies of the two particles involved. That means that if we take the product of these two, then ij, ji is simply equal to twice the Lorentz product of the two vectors. And that's precisely where, again, just as a reminder, the convention in some of the literature will be opposite, and you'll have a minus sign on the other side. Yes? It's essentially measuring the, if you like, the transverse, it's translating the transverse components into an angle. So the transverse components of the original momentum vector, it's translating them into a phase, and I leave it as an exercise to show that it really is a phase.
Is the fact that, well, we took away the degree of freedom here, because we now have only 5k, k plus, k minus, so is that a consequence of having massless particles?
Bingo. So the one of the points of writing out these formulae is to emphasize that these are not just abstract objects. They're objects you can compute numerically with. In fact, they're objects you should compute numerically with, because in general, amplitudes have expressions in terms of these spinner products, whereas they would not necessarily have expressions, simple expressions in terms of Lorentz invariants. A kind of a classic example, which I'm not going to work out for you, but if you look at some trace of gamma matrices, let's say n gamma matrices where n is even, then you can work this out in terms of Lorentz invariants, but it's a lot more complicated than writing it out in terms of spinners. So try it for, let's say, n equals 2, so 4 objects you'll already see it, and for 6, then I think you'll be convinced. So these are things you can work with numerically, and there are standard packages that actually implement these. One of them is called SAM, due to Daniel Maître and Pier Paolo Mastrolia, but I'm sure there are others. It's not that hard to cook up your own. So let's, in the last few minutes, let's look at a few properties of this spinner product. So first of all, the thing that's obvious from its definition and is that it's anti-symmetric in its arguments. So both of these, and I want a new piece of chalk. And of course, as a consequence, it also means that the spinner product of a spinner with itself is going to vanish. And again, here is another exercise. Show that lambda and lambda tilde our solutions to the Weyl equation. We can also reconstruct momenta from the two spinners. That's, of course, pretty trivial in this language. We just need to multiply by sigma and then contract the indices appropriately. For historical reasons, this goes under the name, the fancy name of the Gordon identity. And what it says here is that, and now I'll just use the slicker notation, that if I sandwich a sigma mu, which again is a kind of a notational shortcut, then I should write it the other way around. I'll just sometimes just put the mu in without putting the sigma, that this thing is equal to twice the corresponding momentum. We also have a charge conjugation. So these are kind of straightforward properties that you don't even really have to think about so much. So now let me use this notation, which I've just defined here, is just going to be J mu I. Again, in this language, there's nothing particularly complicated. There are two properties which are less trivial and which are going to be very helpful as in explicit computations, one of which is the Fiertz identity, which whose SUN version you actually saw this morning. So if we try to contract two vectors together where the spinners are carrying different labels. I mean, clearly, if I and J were the same, and if the same were also true for Q and R, there's a slight abuse of notation in that one of these mu's is implicitly lower and the other is upper. If Q were R and I were J, then of course I'd just be contracting two Lorentz vectors together, and I just get some Lorentz product. But one can contract them even if those statements are not true. And then, as you might expect, you have essentially two objects here which are lambdas and two which are lambda tildes. So you should get kind of the natural thing to get. This is obviously some kind of Lorentz invariant, would be to get something that has one lambda product and one bracket product, one lambda tilde product, and the only thing you really have to think a little bit about is what's the sign. This is really the only combination that you could write together. The last tool for analytic calculations is actually probably the most important identity, at least if you actually end up doing any analytic calculations. And it stems from the observation that any two-dimensional vector can be written as a linear combination of two vectors. That's just the statement that vector spaces have bases. So if we imagine that we have some spinner, let me actually write it out again in our more compact notation. So if I choose as basis vectors lambda I and lambda j, I can express any spinner Q using them. We can now contract with, if we want to solve for Ci and Cj, we can contract with angle I and angle j, because, for example, if we contract with angle I, this term is going to vanish, and we're simply going to be able to solve for Cj. We find that each of these coefficients is simply a ratio of angle products. And just keeping track of the signs. So if we now do a further contraction, so this is still a spinorial object, but if we want an identity, if you have some expression which is ultimately a scalar, it's going to be written in terms of spinor products. There are not going to be any free alpha or alpha dot indices. So we can contract this identity with another angle R, for example, with another spinor. And then we obtain an identity which has this form. It's a rearrangement identity. And just going to give you a quick mnemonic for remembering the order of these factors. Is there any colored chalk?
Lower the
this one? Yes. Although it's kind of strange colors, I don't know if they show up too well. No. Ah. All right. Yellow. That's good. No, that's purple. Purple and blue don't show up well on a black background because your fovea doesn't have any blue-yellow cells. So this thing is called the Schouten identity. And the way to remember is that it's you essentially get, for one term, you get a closed cycle. And for the other term, it simply keeps the order the same. So the closed cycle gives you the first term, and the same order gives you the second term. So let me actually stop here, and we will finish up a little discussion of spinors tomorrow, and then we'll start doing some calculations. Yes.
I didn't understand over there. So there's two equations for the ij with the square brackets, but they have something different on the right-hand side. Like the third
right
lines over there on that blackboard.
So the there's a condition here that the there's an energy component. So this is just the special. So roughly speaking, you would think that the angle product should be the complex conjugate of the bracket product. It's just from the way the spinors are laid out, and you look at the formula. And the purpose of this is to say that that's almost true. There's just you just have to keep track of the signs of the energy components.
Oh, okay. So the first one is just a subset of.
It's just a special case of it's a special case which is there to confirm your prejudice if you've been following that it should be true, and then the second one is there to tell you that there's a slight caveat. Sure. So, I'm not sure I can get it back anymore, but all right. Can I borrow the pen for a second?
No more questions? Okay, yeah. Is this Schouten identity something like a Jacobian identity? Is that how we should think of it? Or?
Well, there are probably many different ways you can think of it. The way that I think of it intuitively is that it's really a relation. So in n dimensions, there's going to be relations between n plus 1 different epsilon tensors because they're not all independent. And this is the two-dimensional version of that. But I also think, and that, I mean, that's kind of, I'm just saying in different words what I said a few minutes ago. This is the existence of that kind of identity is really dimension independent. And is it in disguise? I don't think of it in disguise as a Jacobi identity for SON, but maybe you could rephrase it in that form. I haven't really thought about that.
This kind of data system is only useful for calculating MTOs or has other use?
Well, spinners, the notion of taking a square root of a vector. So here, what I've shown you is the four dimensional form of it, but you can also do this fairly straightforwardly in six dimensions. And there probably is a certain sense in which you can do this in other dimensions. I think to some extent in 10 dimensions, subject to more constraints. So there are other applications. Any place where the a constraint of this sort, the determinant of something is going to vanish, you can imagine having applications. So it's certainly useful in practical calculations. I think it's also plays an underlying a very important role in the geometry of things like Grassmannian space and twisters and things like that. So these objects are sitting there. They clearly have a very deep significance in quantum field theory. So I think both from a formal point of view and from a practical calculational point of view, they're very useful things, and they're certainly essential to be comfortable with.
So a lot of this relied on using helicity state. Is there any extension of twisters to massive state?
Okay. So I was actually planning to say something about that at the beginning of tomorrow's lecture, but I don't want to keep you waiting until then. So let me show you one way in which you can kind of very straightforwardly apply these ideas to massless particles. So let's suppose we have some k squared that actually is m squared. One way that might happen is if this k is a sum, in fact, even in the context of massless theories, you end up with sums of momenta all the time, right? So this might be, instead of m squared, it might be Sij. So we can introduce some reference vector q, and we want it to be null. And then we can define something I call a flatted vector to be something where we subtract off the part of the vector that in some sense contains the mass, and it's a one-line exercise to show that this flatted vector is now null. So you can now construct spinners that are associated with it, and there are many contexts in which this is a very natural kind of thing to do. In some cases, there may even be a natural choice of this reference vector, so that the objects you form are very natural. In other cases, you just have to introduce one by hand.
Is there any sense of this in odd dimensions at all?
Well, I don't know. People may have played with this. There are, of course, the SO 2n minus 1 groups also have spinorial representations, but they're real, and so I somehow suspect that they're not likely to lead to anything useful, but that might be wrong. You might be able to do something interesting there. In general, the dimensions that are going to be the more interesting ones are going to be the ones where you have a complex spinner representation, so it's things of the form n, 6, 10, and so on and so forth, to 4n plus 4n plus 2.
More questions?
Certainly in six dimensions, this is something you can do and is actually useful. So, and maybe in odd dimensions, you should just think of embedding it in one higher dimension to, or three higher dimensions, as the case may be, to construct something.
All right, so
We have a break now, so how about we take a 15-minute break till 4:10, and then Simona will give a second lecture.